my gosh. Should we say, you know, holy, you know what, on television?
It's the biggest shock I have ever seen in electoral politics.
You can see I'm speechless. It's not often that I'm speechless, and I am not alone in this town.
How could that poll have been so wrong?
What on earth happened here?
All right, now it's our turn to pile on. Shockwaves reverberated through Washington earlier this week when House Majority Leader Eric Cantor was defeated by his primary opponent in Virginia. We'll talk in a minute about what role polling may have played in the surprise defeat. But first, we turn our attention to Iraq, a country that seems to be unraveling with shocking speed. Kurdish soldiers have reportedly captured the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. The rebels say the Iraqi army didn't even put up a fight there. This comes closely after a jihadist group known as ISIS took over Mosul and Tikrit. ISIS, which stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, is now marching towards Baghdad. For a primer on this group, who they are, what they want, and if they're likely to get it, we turn to a former British intelligence officer and former head of a UN anti-terrorism team. Richard Barrett is now senior vice president of the Sufan Group, a security consultancy firm. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a step back from the news, if we could. What are the origins of ISIS?
Well, there was a guy called Abu Musab al-Zarqawi who was in Afghanistan in a training camp. In fact, he was running a training camp before 2001. So he was already a bit of a radical, though his origins were more as a sort of petty hoodlum in Jordan. And then after the expulsion of the al-Qaeda guys and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, he sort of hung about a bit and then went into northern Iraq. And then when the American invasion started there, 2003, he brought a few people together and then founded a group which he called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was closely allied to Al-Qaeda. And in fact, he sort of swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda. And they were responsible for some pretty horrible things, both in Iraq and indeed the bombings in Amman and so on, of the hotels, you may remember. And he got a reputation for real ruthlessness and therefore attracted quite a lot of people to his side and became pretty prominent, actually, during the American occupation and eventually got found and killed by the American forces. Now, when he died, his successor banded together with a whole load of other sort of rejectionist extremists, and they formed something called the Islamic State of Iraq. And that carried on really fighting the Maliki government or the Shia-dominated government in Iraq until in 2010, the leader of that, a guy called Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, got killed. And then the new leader was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who's now the head of ISIS. And we might not have heard very much more about him, except that in 2011, when they realized that things in Syria were really getting quite serious, they sent over a group of Syrian members of ISI, as it was, Islamic State of Iraq, to found a new branch there. And these guys began to attract a great deal of support, but also to sort of veer towards independence. And so Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared towards the end of last year that he was renaming the group as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria and al-Sham. It means, in fact, more than Syria. It means the whole of the Levant. Order to be able to try and absorb this new Syrian group back into his ranks.
So you have just beautifully explained how the many acronyms and the evolving name really are tracking the evolution of this group's ambitions and also their connections to al-Qaeda, the tree of connections. So ISIS has been described, though, as more brutal than al-Qaeda. How so? Why?
Well, it's certainly very brutal. I'm not sure that I'd say it was more brutal than al-Qaeda. I think al-Qaeda is pretty brutal, too, and neither of them stop short of killing women and children and anybody else who happens to be in the way that when they set off these bombs around the world, but particularly now, of course, in Iraq and Syria. But what's interesting, I think, at the moment is that somehow al-Qaeda is managing to gain some sort of legitimacy, if you like to say that, or acceptability, by looking more moderate than ISIS, than Baghdadi's group. And the Syrian group that he tried to reabsorb has now declared that it's going to stick with al-Qaeda, and therefore it's not going to obey what Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi tells them to do. And Their tactics in Syria are to be much more gentle with the local populace, you know, much less inclined to chop people's hands off or hang them up or shoot them in the back of the head and all these things which are so common for ISIS.
But and ISIS is saying that's how they're going to institute Sharia law now in Iraq.
Yeah, they seem to believe that that's a good way of governing. Yeah, but I think that the problems that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had, which if we go back to 2004, was that he was just too brutal and he failed to win enough public support to really make Iraq catch fire. Now, it seems for the moment that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi hasn't suffered the same problem, but he may if he goes on being as brutal as he has been in Syria.
And can you flesh out the profile of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? He's a former preacher. He has degrees in Islamic studies. He was taken as a prisoner by the Americans in 2005. Could you fill that out for us?
Yeah, he's a man in his early 40s. As you say, he comes from quite a sort of well-respected and religious family, a scholarly family too, and he didn't indeed go to university and studied Islamic law. He has kept himself pretty quiet. He's not sort of gone out to have a big profile and tell everybody about his family and everything and sort of, you know, supermarket magazine spreads or anything, because he's understood, I think, that when his predecessors did that, well, they pretty quickly got droned or killed in some other way. So he's been careful to sort of maintain a lowish profile, but essentially I think that he's proved himself to be a very effective and ruthless leader and somebody who can bring a lot of people to his cause who aren't necessarily in sync with his sort of ideological position.
Now, why did the American forces in Iraq in 2005 let him go? And what's known about his time as a captive at Camp Buka?
Well, I think he was there for about 4 or 5 years. And during that time, there were a lot of hardcore extremists in Camp Buka. And so he was able to get in touch with them, listen to them, form friendships and alliances with them. So when he came out, I think people were a bit surprised in 2010 when he took over the Islamic State of Iraq, as it then was. But, of course, he had these very good contacts, and he probably had very good contacts, too, among old Ba'athists, among members of Saddam Hussein's army and other people who might have been in Camp Buka. And he was able to leverage all these contacts into now, today, making a network of people who can share a common interest, at least to the extent of wanting to attack al-Maliki.
And are those contacts, is that what is helping his insurgency speed along their route through Iraq?
I'm quite sure it is, yeah. He's clearly got some very good tacticians, if not strategists, with him, and they may very well be ex-Iraqi army people. And also, he's able to make contact with the local tribes, other people who may be disaffected with the way Iraq's going at the moment. And so he's clearly got a very good finger on the pulse of Iraqi society and the Sunni heartlands between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers.
Well, ISIS is marching towards Baghdad. Do you think the city can defend itself?
I think to take Baghdad is quite a stretch, but there's no doubt of the guy's ambition, and we needn't think that he has to do this week or next week. I mean, he will, if he can't do it quickly with the momentum he's got, if he's checked, then he'll consolidate, but he'll maintain that ambition because this is the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria. So it's not going to stop just in the Sunni heartlands of Syria and Iraq. Its ambition is to take over southern Iraq as well, even Kuwait, and then on the other side, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, of course, because this would be the Levant on the west side and the sort of greater Iraqi area on the east side.
Richard Barrett, former British intelligence officer and former head of a UN anti-terrorism team. He's currently senior vice president of the Soufan Group. And thank you so much for such a lucid explanation. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, Bella.
From fighting in Iraq now to demonstrations in Brazil. The first World Cup game, Brazil versus Croatia, is scheduled to kick off shortly in Sao Paulo. But protests in Brazil's biggest city are ongoing. And today, police used tear gas and smoke bombs to disperse the demonstrators. Joe Leahy is Brazil Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He's based in Sao Paulo. Thanks, Joe, for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Evan.
So where are you right now?
I'm actually entering the stadium in Sao Paulo at the moment. I'm sort of surrounded by a lot of very excited fans. But as you mentioned earlier, there were some protests earlier in the morning, and they were broken up by riot police, and there's some foreign reporters who are also injured. So I'm here with the people who are very animated about the games, and then outside we have the people who are against it.
So you're surrounded by fans, but I do want to ask you just for a moment about the protests before we move on to soccer. I heard a reporter in Rio de Janeiro say that police were running between revelers in national soccer colors and protesters in anarchist masks. So do you have the same groups out on the streets in Sao Paulo, people celebrating the soccer and people also protesting?
Yes, we do. There's a group of very hardcore protesters that have developed over the past year or so. Known as the Black Bloc protesters here, and they were very active this morning around the stadium here, and we're conducting running battles with the police near one of the metro stations. So there is a movement to try to pick up. We haven't got to the point yet last year where we saw the mass demonstrations, where we saw on one day about a million people coming out against the cup, and. You know, people who are concerned about spending on the stadiums for the cup, when public services in Brazil are lacking.
So police and protester tension, but any tensions between soccer fans and protesters?
At this point, I haven't seen any. The fans are very animated as they're coming into the stadium, and we're about to get to the opening ceremony. Frankly, wouldn't expect too much tension today between the Croatian supporters and the Brazilians. But Brazil is very keen to win this game, and if they don't win, then there'll be quite a few disappointed fans around Sao Paulo tonight.
Well, we've heard about all of this construction problems with the stadiums, and there's a brand new stadium that's been built there in Sao Paulo. So, how ready is that for today's game?
Yeah, so far. This is the first time this stadium will have been operated at full capacity. So far, there's no sign of any problems, but it's only just beginning. The stadium is just filling up now as we speak. I'm watching a stream of people in yellow and green T-shirts, the colours of Brazil, flowing into the stadium. Once it's full, we'll have about 65,000 people in it. So we're going to have to see and hold our breath to make sure to see whether or not this stadium will hold up to the challenge.
And then there's the issue with the monorail that collapsed 2 days ago in Sao Paulo. It sounds like that won't be ready for the World Cup crowds?
Yeah, so the monorail is a project it's a very big project in Brazil, in Sao Paulo. It definitely won't be ready for the World Cup. This collapse was not really related to the World Cup project, but it certainly worried a lot of people in terms of, you know, when projects are being rushed, as this stadium that I'm standing at now was, people will start to become concerned about the quality of the construction.
There are also protests going on the part of strikers for the subways, but I hear the crowd all around you. Has that stopped people from getting into the stadium?
Yes, we saw last night, fortunately for the football fans, the Sao Paulo Metro workers decided to continue with the suspension of a strike that they had here. So there's no strike on the metro here. But early this morning in Rio, there was suddenly an airport strike, which did disrupt some flights, and we saw some flights cancelled. It happened quite early, and it ended fast. So it's not clear whether or not fans are unable to get here from Rio. But certainly the unions have been very active and have been trying to hold the government ransom ahead of this event. So I think we can expect a little bit more of that as we go through.
And right now, is the stadium just starting to fill up or at capacity or what?
It's just starting at the moment. So I don't know if you can hear the music behind me, but they're starting the opening ceremony and we've got people sort of flowing in. So I would say it's it's probably around about half capacity at the moment. There's still people flowing in from all over the place.
And, you know, we're seeing headlines here in the U.S. about how this World Cup has made Brazilians hate soccer, which I'm reading with such skepticism. What do you feel there in Sao Paulo today?
Yeah, I think this is this situation is much more nuanced than that. I think it's not that Brazilians hate soccer. I think they don't hate the World Cup. They love the World Cup. After all, they're the 5 times winner of the event. And this is the country that, you know, people really see as the spiritual home of soccer. What they are becoming more and more impatient of is all public services. And Brazil has problems with the schooling, with education. Security on the streets is still very poor, and I think people have come through a decade of economic growth. A lot of them have come from poverty into the middle class, and now they're starting to demand better services from the government. And I think this will be the legacy of this tournament. Will be this desire from Brazilians to go to that next level, to demand more of their government.
So the first game will kick off soon. What are you expecting for the opening ceremony?
Yes, I think in the opening ceremony will be sort of a party type of atmosphere. We'll have, Jennifer Lopez will be playing, and it's going to be your classic opening ceremony of any large sporting event. President Bill apparently is going to attend, but it's unclear whether or not she will say anything or really appear in public. Last year during the Confederations Cup, the dress rehearsal for the World Cup, She attended the opening match and gave a speech and was actually booed. So this time there's talk that she'll actually stay very low-key here. She'll be here, but she won't appear in public. And I actually heard some members of the crowd as they were coming in saying nasty things about her. So I think that she'll keep a low profile because she's aware that there is a lot of public discontent with the spending on these games.
Anything else you can tell us that surprised you or stood out as you struggle to get into the stadium?
Yes, well, I think one thing that's kind of surprising me is the poor telecommunications, to be honest. My emails weren't working. I have 2 phones. I've got 2 different services to try and get around this problem, and they haven't been working. So I think, you know, the problem of logistics and poor infrastructure is one that will continue to dog Brazil. The other issue was getting to the stadium actually wasn't difficult because the government called a public holiday. Knowing that if they didn't have a public holiday today, it would be almost impossible for the traffic to get here. So I think, you know, the thing that's really amazed me is it really has been the Brazilians' risk resistance to the idea of the expenditure on this World Cup. And in the lead up to the World Cup, they have been very quiet. They've been unusually subdued, and it's only now that they're starting to get into the party atmosphere and let themselves relax.
Well, good luck filing, Joe Leahy, Brazil Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, and thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Barbara. Pleasure.
And heads up, the first World Cup game is scheduled to kick off right after our show at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Well, closer to home, we want to know what you think. Are protests in Brazil about social and economic inequality affecting your appetite for all things World Cup? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY, and maybe we'll talk about you later in the show. Coming up, Dewey beats Truman. Eric Cantor must have a whole new reading on that historic flub. When pollsters go wrong. That's just ahead on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Well, we've been hitting the international headlines. Now let's turn to the national landscape. We talked yesterday about the stunning defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor this week in Virginia's 7th District. Nobody predicted that Cantor would lose to a no-name Tea Party-backed economics professor. But least of all, Cantor's pollster, John McLaughlin. Less than a week before the election, McLaughlin forecasted that Cantor would win by 34 percentage points. Instead, he lost by 10. How did the pollster get it so wrong? And what does it tell us about the limits of polls as a thermometer for the political climate? Shane Goldmacher is the congressional correspondent for the National Journal, and he joins me now. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
44 percentage points. Could you put this in context for us? How wrong was McLaughlin, and is this a Guinness Book of World Records mistake?
This is certainly one of those things that's going to be used in textbooks and political science classes for a long time about polls aren't always right. This is sort of the example of getting it terribly, terribly wrong and on the biggest possible stage. Another prominent pollster today, Frank Luntz, wrote in an op-ed of the New York Times that this was a whopper for the ages and it was quantitative malpractice.
Wow, harsh words. But what's a normal margin for error with a political poll?
So every poll at the end, there's a fine language that says, you know, this is a plus or minus of 5 percentage points or 3 percentage points. And what that means is that most of the time, their numbers are within 3 to 5 percentage points. Now, anything that's 45 percentage points away, that's not in the margin of error. There is no statistical reason that something that should be that far off.
Well, it is easy, of course, to Monday morning quarterback any election or Thursday morning quarterback. But what did this pollster miscalculate? And are these mistakes peculiar to this election or common to many?
Well, let's stick with this example first. You know, I emailed with John McLaughlin, who's the name of the pollster. He's a Republican. He's been around for a long time. And problem number one was turnout. So guessing what the electorate looked like. The turnout 2 years ago was 45,000 people in Cantor's district. This time there were 65,000. So he just completely misread who he thought would vote, which is one of the most important things, predicting the electorate for a pollster. Huh. That's problem one. And then he had some other descriptions as well, including Democrats potentially crossing over to vote for Cantor's opponent, sort of playing politics, strategically voting. And he blamed a former congressman and a former actor in Dukes of Hazzard for instigating that plan.
Oh, well, that might be the first time in history that a former actor of Dukes of Hazzard has gamed an election, right? But what was his explanation for these? I'm sure he had a lot of explanations for these three errors.
Yeah, so the first was just he just missed this turnout, and you know that, but that's his job. So the question is why, and you know. Some folks have been pointing out that, look, John McLaughlin, this is not the first time he's missed a poll. Right before the 2012 elections in October, he put out polls predicting that Mitt Romney would win Colorado and Virginia by 4 points and 7 points. Of course, Mitt Romney lost both of those states. He miscalled Senate races. And in one Rhode Island Senate contest, he had the Democrat ahead by 8 points, and he won by 30. Again, none of those are on the scale of a 45-point swing. But still, these are notable and a series of losses that he's gotten wrong.
And getting back to it, is this just an instance of some bad techniques, or is there a larger point for or implications for other elections?
There's certainly implications for other elections, and that is, you know, candidates, politicians, and frankly, readers and voters beware. What the polls say doesn't necessarily mean it's exactly right. Now, the best pollsters, you know, are pretty accurate, and primaries in which Cantor was running are notoriously difficult because in one case you have Democrat, Republican in the fall. That's a little easier to poll, to survey where people come down. When you're in Republican versus Republican land, Democrat versus Democrat, it's a little trickier.
So are you saying that the polling was the decisive factor in the loss?
It's definitely not the decisive factor, but it's one of those things where if you think you're up by 34 points, the way you campaign is very different than if you think you're down by 10 points. Now, Eric Cantor did spend a lot of money in this race. He aired a lot of negative television ads against his opponent, David Bratt. And David Bratt afterwards has said, look, that helped me. That brought my name ID up. I didn't have enough money to air television ads. But yeah, and I mean, the way you strategically plan your campaign, you can't plan it based on your polls. So often people say, hey, you know, are candidates spinning out polls that are inaccurate? Do they just give you fake numbers? And the answer is hopefully the candidates don't want those fake numbers because then they end up spinning themselves.
But that is the spin is the question, right? Pollsters are often partisan. McLaughlin is a veteran Republican surveyor. So how much do political affiliations interfere with objective, and I'm making air quotes, survey taking, because it is all about the questions you're asking, right, and your focus.
Absolutely. I mean, how you ask a question makes a big difference. One of the great examples in current politics is the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. You take a poll about Obamacare, it fares pretty poorly in most of the country. You ask people about the Affordable Care Act, and people like it a whole lot more. It's just a single word, just a difference. How you describe the same thing gets a totally different result.
So how are we to look at polls? Are they a reflection of campaign strategy more than public opinion?
It's less that if you're a candidate, you're taking a poll, you're not trying to take something that skews the result, because ultimately these are great pieces of data for you to decide your strategy. But what they decide to release publicly, that can be very different than what the full survey showed. So always be wary when a campaign says, our own poll shows us up, because they may have asked the question in different ways and they only released the way that makes them look better. So what they release can be strategic and spinning, but ultimately the campaigns themselves don't want to be tricked by their own pollster, because then you can be in the case like Eric Cantor is, you know, losing your race even though he was expected to someday, potentially even next year, become Speaker of the House.
Well, looking at it from a slightly different angle, in general it seems like we're living in such a canned political environment where things are so partisan and so very predictable most of the time. Do you think that that had anything to do with this particular poll being so off?
I mean, one of the challenges for Eric Cantor broadly is that he was running and he was the face of the establishment in Washington, D.C. He's the leader. Every press conference he has, it's in Washington. He's synonymous with Washington establishment Republicans, and people are unhappy with Washington. They're frustrated. And it's a challenge that Mitch McConnell's going to face this fall. It's the challenge that Harry Reid faced a couple years ago when he faced a tough election. And it's hard for polls to necessarily catch that. They always catch this anger with Washington. They catch this unhappiness. But to catch it on a particular candidate and whether or not they're going to win or lose can be a challenge.
Is this kind of thing a catalyst for pollsters to rethink how they operate then? Or do they just get together and say, oh, I'm so glad it wasn't me?
It's absolutely, it should be, whether it will be or won't be. Again, this happened in 2012. There was a lot of talk about Mitt Romney heading into election night, thought he was going to win. His own pollsters said he had a chance. There were swing states. There was that famous scene on election night where Karl Rove was saying, wait, Ohio's not done yet. There was a sort of term that went around called unskewing the polls. Republicans said, look, polls were all tilted toward the Democrats and they're all wrong. It turned out that they were wrong, but there was a huge sort of self-reflection. But at the end of the day, many of the pollsters who got those things wrong, including John McLaughlin, including Rasmussen, which is another one of those leading Republican pollsters, they're still getting hired and they're still doing polling for candidates all across the country.
Shane Goldmacher is the congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the lives of others, Adam's Rib, Brazil. What do these things have in common? They're among my favorite films, and they didn't make it into film critic Ken Turan's book, his list of 54 favorite films. It's called Not to Be Missed, and it's not to be missed next. After the news with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Madeline Brand. Ken Turan is film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition. In the 40 years that he's been reviewing films, he's seen some good ones, some bad ones, and a lot that fall very much in between. And now he's written about some of his favorites in a wonderful new book called Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. And be forewarned, this book is dangerous. I have completely neglected all my other work and my family since picking it up. He's very consciously mashed up old favorites like Casablanca and The Godfather with at least some you've probably never heard of, like this one, an English film called Kes.
You see, if you're not like the others, if you simply don't belong, then you have to manage alone. Unless you have a friend like Kes.
Come on, Kes. Come on, then.
A very special friend. who doesn't mind that you're different.
Ken Turan, welcome to Press Play.
It's good to be here.
So tell us about Kes and what qualified it for your list.
Oh, gosh. All these films are films that just blew me away the first time I saw them, and I can see again and again and still have that same feeling. And Kes is very much that way. It's by Ken Loach, who's a British director, who really wanted realism above all else.
Observation, not manipulation.
Yes. So he went to the North Country. He used local people, not actors.
Right, non-professionals.
Non-professionals. And he, you feel like you're in these people's lives. This is about a young boy who is basically on his own and forms this relationship with a kestrel hawk.
Kes! Come on, lass!
It so pulls you in, and it meets one of my criterion as a non-critic, which is that sometimes I feel watching that movie and other of my favorites that I'm not so much watching a movie as I'm living this in real time.
Yes, that's a wonderful feeling, you know, and that's what we go
like
for.
That.
We want to be in it, you know, and with this film, you're definitely in it.
Now, what were your other criteria for picking these oddly numbered 54 movies? Which we'll get to.
These were the films that I cared most about. I mean, actually the balance that you mentioned was almost accidental. I didn't try for that. I didn't say, well, now I've got too many well-known films. I've got to pull in some obscure ones. It's just the way my mind works. These are all the films that I really love. And I was gratified that it worked out that way. But this was not a plan.
Okay.
You know, I built this list one film at a time, basically.
Agonizingly, from what I can tell from the book.
Oh, I mean, it was harder to get this down to 54 than to write the book.
And why 54?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I wanted a reasonable number. And I said, well, if something in the 50s alliterates with film and alliterates with favorite, I'll do something in the 50s. And then I said, well, maybe 54. And I thought nothing more of it. I thought it was just a random number. And when I mentioned this to a friend of mine who said, how many films? And I said, 54. He immediately said, three times chai, three times 18. 18 in the Jewish tradition is a lucky number. It's the same word for 18 and for life. And somewhere in my subconscious, I knew this because this is how I was raised. But I picked 54 without realizing why I picked it.
And you write about having grown up Jewish and having the experience of explicating and analyzing the Talmud.
Yeah.
How did that training then influence the way you watched movies?
It just made the sense of analysis natural for me. I mean, this is not something I turn on and off. This is not something I do as a job. I was thinking about films this way for as long as I've been watching them. This is just kind of natural to me.
So if you hadn't become a critic, would you have become a rabbi?
I don't know. Would have made my father happy if I'd become a rabbi, but I don't think that was in the cards.
Well, let's talk about some of these wonderful films. The first time that I put down your book to find a film, and I had to track it down, it was for The Earrings of Madame De, which somehow I'd never seen.
You made a wise choice.
It's so wonderful. And for people who haven't seen it, remind us what it's about.
It's a French film. It's a great romance. I mean, I am a romantic, and this is one of the classic romantic films. It's about set in like the 19th century France. It revolves around a pair of earrings, and it's a kind of an ill-fated, doomed romance between a countess and a diplomat. And
yet there's a romance between her and her husband.
Yes.
It's just a very, very dark and complicated one.
Yeah, the emotions in this film are very complicated. They're very adult and sophisticated.
Sophisticated is the word, yeah.
But the thing that makes this film really magical is the camera movement. This is a film by Max Ophuls, who was, you know, celebrated for the way he moved the camera. And there's a scene at the heart of this film where these two people, played by Vittorio De Sica and Daniel Dariot, they meet in a series of balls.
4 jours sans vous voir. On ne danse donc plus à Paris.
C'est pour vous laisser le temps de faire de la politique étrangère.
And they're intercut, their dances on different nights are intercut into one kind of continuous scene. And it is magical beyond magical.
And it follows the development of their affair.
Exactly.
From scene to scene. And it matches perfectly. They do a turn, and then in the next scene, they're just wearing different clothes, but they're doing the same turn.
Henriette de Grandpierre.
Oh, et alors?
I mean, I had the experience of seeing this with a crowd of people who hadn't seen just that scene before, and people were speechless. It's just one of the amazing sequences, I think, in the entire history of film.
Well, going even further back to the 30s, you've included Love Affair with Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer.
July 1st, 5 o'clock, 102nd floor, top of the Empire State Building.
Yes.
That's it right there. It's the tallest building in the world. You can't miss that. It's the nearest thing to heaven we have in New York. Be sure you take the elevator. Well, until we meet again, take care of yourself.
Clearly a romantic here also, and this is a Hollywood romance, but it's so realistic and kind of also very dark. So could you give us the context for this film and why you hold a candle for the director, Leo McCarey?
Well, Leo McCarey really made films. I mean, he was a Hollywood director, but he made kind of human comedies. But the emphasis was on human. I think he really understood character. He empathized with character. And the people in this film, the two people who the love affair is between, they meet on a ship, and they're just not quite sure if they want to, you know, connect with each other. I mean, they love each other, but they're not quite sure if this is going to work in the real world. And they make arrangements to meet at a certain day at a certain time. And I won't say any more than that.
So you don't want to spoil a movie from the 30s.
I don't want to spoil it. You know, I mean, again, the first time I have such vivid memories of the first time I saw these films. And, you know, in some ways, and I try very hard in what I write about these films not to give things away, because I know that people want to experience it for themselves, and I want them to experience it for themselves. That's why I wrote the book, so that people could enjoy these films.
Yeah, and one of the other wonderful things you do at the end of every chapter, you offer other films. If you like this film, go see these.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just leads you down a spiral that never ending.
Well, there's so many wonderful
deaf movie
films.
Wonderful movies, Morrow.
I mean, again, we always complain because there are an enormous number of dreadful films and more dreadful films than good ones. But if you're open to the entire history of film, there are so many wonderful films to be seen.
Ken Turan is my guest. He's the film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition. And he has a new book called Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. Well, we talked earlier about a movie called Cast that many people haven't seen. Do you have another movie that you chose for this list that is likely not to have been seen by many people?
Well, there's a documentary that really had a huge impact on me that I really would love to get people to see. It's called The Day After Trinity.
In August of 1945, the city of Hiroshima was destroyed in about 9 seconds by a single atomic bomb. The man responsible for building the bomb was a gentle and eloquent physicist named J. Robert Oppenheimer.
It's about the men and women who made the atomic bomb at Los Alamos during World War II, who they were, what kind of people made this horrific weapon, why they did it, what it did to them to make this weapon. It is such a powerful story. It's an astonishing story, and it just kind of really, you know, it's a bad pun, but it really blew me away when I saw this film. And I think, it gives you such insight into how things like this happen. You think, how did this horrible weapon come to be? And when you talk to the people, you hear the people talk who made it, it's just astonishing.
Stinson Beach, California, August 7th, 1945. Dear Oppie, you are probably the most famous man in the world today, and yet I am not sure that this letter will reach you. But if it does, I want you to know that we are very proud of you. And if it doesn't, you'll know it anyway.
Well, is there one movie in this list that people particularly responded to and it was just very controversial? They just don't agree with your estimation of it.
Well, there's one movie that's very tough to watch, which I called Leolo. It's a French-Canadian film. It's a story of his childhood. He had a very brutal childhood, and he tells his own story in a very brutal yet very poetic way. And there are scenes in this film that just fry people.
Devastating.
Yeah.
They're devastating.
And so people just, but I mean, I was so floored by the honesty of this film and, you know, how much it captured a certain element of the hopelessness of childhood and the despair of childhood, but the hope of childhood.
So the hope outweighed the despair for you.
Yeah. And the honesty outweighed everything. I mean, the filmmaker, he's a director I had a chance to interview, and he said, you know, I didn't want to make this film. I didn't want to make a film about poor people. This is my past. You know, he said, I wanted to make, you know, films that beautiful women will come up to me about, not this. But he was just driven to make this story, to tell his own story. And it's an astonishing film, but it's very, very, very hard to take.
Well, looking at the classics that you've chosen, and you've chosen many, they include Casablanca, Singing in the Rain, The Godfather, All About Eve, but no Lawrence of Arabia.
I almost put Lawrence of Arabia in there. It was a very close call. I couldn't tell you at this moment why I didn't put Lawrence of Arabia in there.
It's a total toss-up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I made this Procrustean number 54, and there had to be 54. And for whatever reason, you know, I really felt that this list was like a living thing. It changed from day to day. Some days I felt, well, maybe I'll put this film in, maybe I'll put that film in. And these films kind of called out to me. They said, you know, Ken, don't leave us behind in the darkness. Put us in the list, you know. Remember how much you liked us. You know, I really felt these films were kind of pleading with me to be included. So some of them didn't get included, and I feel bad about Lawrence of Arabia. It's a really landmark film for me, and it's the kind of film that isn't made anymore. Widescreen, intelligent, big-budget epics. They don't do this anymore.
Well, and that you're anticipating my next question, which is that the book, by the way, is organized by decade. And I was pretty much right there with you through the 70s, which were The Godfather and Chinatown. But after that, your choices got more idiosyncratic and more European leaning. Leolo, The Best of Youth, The Five Obstructions. Did the American cinema just not hold up for you in the 90s and beyond?
You know, it's interesting. I wrote this book, as I said, one film at a time. And it wasn't until it was finished and talking to my editor, we decided, well, let's organize it chronologically. Never even thought about that. And once I did that and I noticed that, I was surprised. You know, I said, boy, how come these are all European films? And, you know, it's not that I loved the American films less. I seem to love these films more. These were the ones that stood out more. You know, film reviewing is intensely personal. And it is what you like is a function of who you are at any given point in time.
Hmm. Well, you got to the 54th film, and it sounds like you just could not decide. you hit a wall. So you resorted to desperate measures. What did you do?
Well, I wrote an additional chapter called The 55th Film. And not only did I do that, I divided that between two films.
Oh, and then it just got ridiculous. Yeah.
And then I had to list a second 54. You know, again, the goal in this, I mean, the reason you become a critic, you know, it's interesting. When I was in college, I took a course in the New Testament, which I didn't know much about because I'd been raised Orthodox Jewish. And they told me that the word gospel meant the spreading of the good news, spreading of the good news about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And that notion stayed with me. And it's one of the things I try to do as a critic is to spread the good news about films that people will enjoy.
Ken Turan, film critic for Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition, and his new book is called Not to Be Missed. Thank you so much. I love talking with you.
Well, thank you. Me too.
Moving on next on Press Play, antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It's scary enough, but at least it's not in our food, right? Wrong. For the first time, scientists have found it in a food product, in frozen squid. On the trail of a superbug. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin from Madeline Brand. Just what you need. One more reason to worry about what you eat. But here it is. Frozen squid is causing alarm for infectious disease scientists concerned about superbugs. Researchers have found a highly resistant bacteria in a frozen squid imported from South Korea. The squid was for sale in a Canadian grocery store. Well, up until now, this particular bacteria was most often found in hospitals or contaminated water. And this is the first time it's shown up in food products. Scientists say it could unfortunately be a game changer. For more, we turn to the researcher who made the squid discovery, Joe Rubin. He's an assistant professor of veterinary microbiology at the University of Saskatchewan. And he just published his findings in the CDC's Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal, a publication I read regularly. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I didn't mean to make light of frozen squid, or certainly not superbugs. So tell us more about this specific class of bacteria that you found in the squid.
Well, what we found, and really the most interesting thing about this organism, isn't the bacteria itself. It's actually the resistance gene that it has. So it contains a gene which encodes for an enzyme called a carbapenemase. And what a carbapenemase is an enzyme that allows bacteria to degrade some of our most important last line of defense antibiotics, drugs that doctors reach for when treating resistant infections in hospitals.
Well, this sounds awful. I also understand it's a gut bacteria, right?
This particular organism is probably more of an environmental organism. But what we're concerned with finding this enzyme is that this bacteria could potentially share these genes with other bacteria. So bacteria can share DNA with each other. And you can think about this. The analogy I like to use is that if I have blue eyes and you have brown eyes and I want to change my eye color, I could take that gene from you and poof, it would all be changed immediately. That's what bacteria have the ability to do. And so what's really concerning is that this organism could share that resistance gene with bacteria in our intestines and potentially some more pathogenic organisms that are more likely to cause disease.
Oh, I see. That's where the gut got in there. That's where they pass the diseases once we eat this. And that's, is that
so.
How the bacteria got into the squid?
You know, we actually don't know how it got into the product that we tested. So there's a few possibilities. It could have picked it up in the environment. Maybe this organism was floating around wherever the squid was living in the ocean. It could have been cross-contamination at processing or shipping, any step along the supply chain. Or it could be something which happened at the retail level. We just unfortunately don't know yet.
So a lot of investigative work ahead of you. Now, if it's a bacteria that the transmission, or at least the genetic material, is transmitted in the gut, does that also mean that this is the dreaded oral fecal transmission path for humans? You know, how easily can you pass this bug around or animals?
So this particular organism, we really don't know a lot about it vis-a-vis people. So it's not something that we typically think of as a pathogen. But certainly fecal-oral transmission or oral transmission of really multiple organisms, whether it's from the feces or a foodborne source, is certainly a really important route of infection.
Well, you're a veterinary microbiologist. How did you end up investigating a squid?
In Canada and actually the United States, we have some really good resistance surveillance programs that look at retail meat. The FDA and in Canada, the Public Health Agency, are trying to protect consumers. And so they routinely do these types of studies, mainly focusing on beef, pork, and poultry. So obviously there's a wide variety of food products out there that aren't routinely sampled. And so what I was really interested in doing was just filling in some of these gaps.
And how did you fill in the gaps? What other gaps did you look at besides squid?
Well, in the preliminary study where these results come from, we tested three different types of samples, or food products, I guess I should say, when they're not in the lab. We had two squids, we had two packages of black sea cucumber, and two packages of frog legs. And of those six samples, the only one where we found this type of organism was one of the squids.
Okay, I don't need any of those things. So right now, I'm feeling a little scared and a little okay, but I don't want to scare people more with yet another hysterical headline about squid. What are the odds that this bacteria is in other food products besides this one frozen squid from South Korea sold in Canada?
Right.
And it usually shows up in hospital ICUs, right, this bacteria? Or this
often,
family
yeah.
of bacteria?
We tend to think about carbapenem-resistant organisms as things that people acquire, actually particularly when they have travel-associated risk factors. So some of these organisms are found in hot spots around the world, and when people visit those areas, either for medical tourism or for holiday, they can come back to Canada or the U.S. or wherever it is that they're originating from, and then if they develop an infection, that seems to be the most common risk factor with these bugs. And that's actually one of the big problems with our finding, is that it indicates that the risk for exposure extends beyond those people. So you don't have to travel anymore. You don't have to have been in a hospital or received antibiotics yourself. It's something that could potentially enter your home through food.
Well, Joe Rubin of the University of Saskatchewan, veterinary microbiologist, I really appreciate this. I do appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your interest.
Good talking with you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Jolie Myers is here. I don't want to know about this, actually, Jolie.
Well, I'm going to skip the calamari tonight, I think, even though it was a Canadian South Korean squid. But sooner than dinner, in about 2 minutes, the first match of the World Cup begins.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
yes.
Barbara, Croatia or Brazil? Who are you rooting for? Are you rooting for lunch right now? Okay. Well, for some of our listeners,
let's say Brazil.
Brazil, okay.
Home I usually team. Go for the underdog, but. You know.
For some of our listeners, it's not about which team they're going to side with. Gustav Kahn commented on Facebook that he sides with the people of Brazil. He'll forego watching soccer this time around in protest. Most of our listeners, though, are excited about the World Cup. Me, I need a little convincing, which our listeners were happy to help out with. On Facebook, Philip Hughes shared what brought him to the gospel of soccer. He said he played when he was a kid, but it wasn't until he was an adult that he really got into watching the game on TV. He said that soccer games in the U.S. have fewer commercials and fewer commercial breaks than American football or basketball. More
well, that,
sports,
it
less
makes bowl. It so much more exciting. That's really true.
It sounds pretty good to me. Yeah. And listener Jay Antonio Vegas is headed to Brazil in a few days. He says that he never had a choice of whether or not he was going to like soccer. He's from South America and the love of soccer or football is in his blood. So
well,
he'll definitely be watching. He'll be on the front lines.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
That was all great. And that's it for today. I hope you have a wonderful time watching the World Cup if you watch. And if you have any thoughts about this show, we'd love to hear them at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. We're also on Twitter at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. I'm Barbara Bogavin from Madeline Brand and I'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.